I'm very pleased to welcome, Free Battleship News. Gerard McCann has just been shortlisted for the Hungerford Award for an unpublished, got my tongue tied this morning, Gerard, unpublished manuscript. Congratulations. How does it feel?
Well, I'm overawed, Michael, mainly because my primary career has been as an architect. But it was quite late in the process of writing a manuscript I realised that I'd become a heritage architect, and my specialty was taking old, decrepit things and bringing them back to new life. And in fact, that's what the manuscript has done on a much deeper inner level, which is pick up the dishevelled and shattered pieces of a broken childhood, really, and restore the sense of integrity in me as an adult. Through a lot of therapy, of course, through my life. But
beautiful, beautiful way to introduce the topic. It's coming up just 10 years ago since you picked up pen and started writing on paper and finished up producing this manuscript. Accompanying this audio podcast interview will be the words which accompany your nomination. But just tell us a little bit about the process by which you came to engage and write what you have written.
I've suffered from sort of these uncontrollable rages all my life, but I'm also a professional person, and so it was tended to be my wife who had to put up with silence, actually. Like, so much rage, I would go silent for days at a time. And through various forms of therapy, they kind of dealt with the day-to-day problems, but it never intrinsically went to the source or the heart of what that rage was. And it was 10 years ago in Melbourne, the Melbourne Age published an article on the Catholic Church running a secret psychiatric clinic for pedophile priests, giving them it cost apparently hundreds of millions of dollars, or over $100 million, to run this program for 11 years. They treated 1,100 people. And at the end of the program, the priests were quietly transitioned out of the church, given a generous payout, a university education, and accommodation for life. When I read this article, it just absolutely opened the floodgates of this uncontrollable rage. Anger that the church could be so diligent in looking after the pedophile priests, but so callous in their treatment of the victims in the courts and when they came to the church privately. Anyway, I was staying with some friends in Melbourne, and they're writers, and they said, oh, you should write your story. So I started writing it the next day, literally. And it started off as a memoir of what had happened to me. And the narratorial voice was of a victim, someone who was responding to what had happened to them. But in the process of it slowly evolved. As I found out there were other boys, I started interviewing the other boys, and the narratorial voice became less mine and more of that of a dispassionate reporter. And it had the double effect of not just telling my story or their stories, but telling everyone's story, but also it enabled me to be less of a victim for myself, as I felt more empowered in being able to write it. I became, I suppose, more of a, I hate to say the word journalist, that might insult you, but like a recorder, a historian in a way. And when I got to the end of the manuscript, I realized I had, in the process of writing it, had traveled this journey of coming to terms with what had happened, and felt so empowered about the validity and the strength and the power of telling the story.
There are so many questions that people no doubt ask, and someone like me interviewing you would like to ask. But the first question for me, really, having understood what happened briefly and what you've done in engaging in writing this memoir, if we can call it that, is to say, has it been good for you? Do you feel really pleased to have done it? And are you in a different place as a result of doing it?
Yes to all of those questions, because at times, sometimes writing it, I would just start crying. And at one point writing, I was just sobbing. And I realized that I had taken myself to a place where the abuses had kind of sewn themselves into my being. It's like they had become part of me. And what I was doing in writing and telling the story to myself, as it was in the early days, was like unstitching this fabric membrane. I liken it almost to concrete, though. You know, it's like chipping away at the opening up. And in that sense, I never felt, though, that this was too traumatic that I should stop. It always felt to me that this is good, you know, and to hold the tension and to hold that space. And I had some fantastic therapists, I have to say, especially at the Sexual Assault Resource Center in Subiaco. One therapist there who I talk a lot about in the manuscript, who was just extraordinarily wise and strong in being able to sort of hold me and guide me to where the feelings had been kind of frozen, as it were, as a child. And so documenting this process, so the less of a memoir, more of narrative nonfiction, it really became the telling of the story of me telling the story. And that in itself kind of created a framework or a scaffold, if you like, on which to hang the story. So it was no longer embedded in me, but it was outside of me on this framework of the written text. And in that sense, I felt like it was extraordinarily healing.
Jared, not everybody has the gift of having enough confidence to write, and then to write and to go through the whole therapeutic process, if you like, that you've gone through. How do others who have been through this process achieve that sort of resolution, if they do? No doubt the therapists help, but what happens to others?
The most important thing, Michael, is to tell the story first, tell someone. Two of my brothers who were abused, they had never told anyone until I went to them finally writing the manuscript and said, look, I'm writing this manuscript. I'm telling my story. I want you to tell me yours. And they both then opened up. And one of them had denied it, you know, he'd been abused, you know, 20 years ago. And then, you know, so then I was saying, well, why didn't you say you'd been abused then? And so out came all the tendrils of shame and guilt, all these things that become embedded as a result of, as a child, being told to not tell the truth, and certainly not tell your parents, that it created such a moral conundrum for an 8, 9, 10-year-old child that there is no way that they can unpack it except with sort of help. But the first step always was just tell the story. I think I'd been fortunate in that as an adolescent, I wrote poetry. And that one of the other things that happened was I'm convinced that my mother knew that her boys were being abused, but she was so embedded in the Catholic Church that she couldn't admit to it, perhaps consciously. And so she became, she had a mental breakdown, was hospitalized for weeks. And there was a lot of anger and trauma in the family. And I was documenting this in poetry at the time. So I kind of have a written record via poetry of what, you know, of her smashing plates and screaming and trying to kill herself. All of this I was recording at the time. And then subsequently, as a young man, I stopped writing poetry and started writing short stories. And so in a way, I've always been prepared to from the writing point of view. And then I did an arts degree majoring in English Lit in the 90s when I was in my 30s and 40s. So I've always kind of felt like I have been a writer, but I've interviewed quite a few boys in the writing, and all of them, I was the first person they were telling, which is extraordinary.
There's been inquiries like we've had in Australia around at least the Western world, to my immediate knowledge, Ireland, the United States, Canada. People from the UK have told their stories. It's virtually not a part of the world that we're familiar with, where it hasn't come to light that there's been sexual abuse in all sorts of settings, but particularly in the churches, and the Roman Catholic Church figures as well as anybody in that sense. Was it something, do you think, that was born of a certain age, the period 40s into the 50s, into the 60s? No doubt it's something that happened any time. If there was something, was there back in then?
It's a really interesting process, because I write a bit about the Royal Commission and how one of my brothers said that he felt like he could tell the story because the Royal Commission had validated it in a way. It was like, up till then, he felt he had no right to talk about it. But somehow the fact that there was this Royal Commission authorised him to be able to talk about it. I haven't really speculated too much about where the origins of this widespread abuse came, but I did interview the brother of the priest who abused me, and a lot of his family, and those boys were abused as young children, and there was a lot of trauma in that family, and it stemmed from the father coming back from the First World War with chronic PTSD. And so in that sense, I could sort of see how the First World War was a trigger for a lot of this trauma. So one answer that I could propose or suggest to your question is that the First World War was the trigger of extreme nihilism, the futility of war, and that the men who came back were expected to just get on with life as though nothing has happened. And they had experienced utter desolation and utter futility of war, and seen all their mates just killed needlessly, and at the end of it all, nothing resolved. So in that sense, perhaps the First World War was a trigger, but also I think there'd been a widespread abuse of boys, particularly in the Catholic Church, which was condoned, you know, right up to the very highest levels. And I think a lot of the bishops in the 50s and 60s just moving priests and around was because they themselves had been part of a system that had abused and been abused and had abused. And that for them to say, well, no, someone, you know, you've got to stop this, was really would be hypocrisy. And my hunch is that maybe they were themselves being exposed to being blackmailed, or who knows, I don't know. But I think it was widespread and accepted.
This notion of disempowerment presumably then pervades all the people running a church, as we talk about the church, feel disempowered for all of these reasons. You obviously felt entirely disempowered until 10 years ago. You were motivated to write about it. When that happened, there was obviously that need to write about it and to tell a broader audience than keep it just within family and friends. But were you wanting to be on a mission for something we might call justice?
Absolutely. Right. In fact, the most meaningful therapy I had was at the Sexual Assault Resource Centre. And the reason I got in touch with them was I finally, after about 20 years of prevaricating, I decided I had to report this priest to the police. And every time I went to, I just chickened out. And finally, I thought, I have to do it. And that was motivated by just a profound sense of unfulfillment about my life. And I thought, I have to do something about this. So I thought, I have to go to the police. I couldn't find the number in the police book, but I found the number for the Sexual Assault Resource Center. So I rang them up. And next thing, I'm in this process of therapy, which went on for, I think, 4 or 5 years. I mean, and it was profound. And by the end of that, I thought, oh, now I can go to the police. And that, then I thought, I have to go back to the church and achieve some sort of justice. And I went, I tried through the Towards Healing program, and I write about that at length. It was about the hypocrisy of that. And then I went to a lawyer, and he said, oh, you won't get justice through the legal system. You might get a remedy, but you won't find justice. But I persevered, and they changed the legislation to allow abolish the statute of limitations on time. And so it slowly wound its way through the judicial process to a mediation where the church proposed an apology and some compensation, but they still maintained that I couldn't prove that I was abused and denied that it had happened. And then it went to a second mediation and the same story. And I said, no, I want my day in court. I want to be able to tell my story. Literally, I want to tell my story. And the church finally settled the week before the trial. But the most important part was they say, we acknowledge that the abuses have happened. They withdrew their defense. And at that moment, in that one sentence, justice was served. They accepted that the abuses have happened. And for years, I mean, in the end, that was all that needed to happen, was an official acknowledgement that I had been abused by this man. And I didn't want an apology, because that to me was meaningless. It was just that no one was defending. And it was, in a sense, what's been saying is, we hear you, we understand, and we acknowledge that it's happened. Now, the Royal Commission did that, but they weren't the perpetrator. It's when the perpetrator's organisation came along and said, we accept that this has happened, that I felt that justice had been served. And that was profound.
Well, why do you think the perpetrator's organisation was so slow, as it sounds as if they were, to provide that acknowledgement?
I think they were terribly ashamed of what had happened. And so, but they're also a male organization, a patriarchal organization, and my father was embedded in it, and he never apologized in his life. So I sort of see it as a key element of that sort of patriarchal institution, is that they cannot apologize, they cannot accept responsibility, and they will always be defensive. So my father was always defended himself. He always justified his wrong or his inaction or whatever. He was never wrong. So I think that they just cannot accept. But also, a lot of the early documentation I had with the church was on their Catholic Church Insurance's notepaper. And so I could hear the language of an insurer: never accept responsibility, even if you've crashed into someone and it's all your fault. Don't accept responsibility, don't accept liability. And I just heard it was the insurance lawyers talking: do not accept responsibility. So whether, as Christian men, the church themselves wanted to publicly get down on their hands and knees and apologize sincerely, their lawyers wouldn't let them. But also, of course, it would mean financial ruin if they were honest. And I write a little bit in the manuscript saying it would be better that the church dissolved itself and gave all the money to all the victims. That would be a much more powerful message that Jesus would have promoted than maintaining the facade that you are the representative, you know, for social justice and meaningful spiritual nurturing of people, when on the other hand you're fighting them in the courts and denying, in my case, that it had ever happened until the absolute very last minute.
Jared, if this hadn't happened to you, and who would know, being hypothetical about this, are there we'll put it in a more positive way, I suppose, has the fact that this has happened to you and you've been through this whole process and all of this trauma over such a period of time, 8, 9, 10 years of age and ever since then, caused you to no longer be committed to views on life you might have had, formal religion? How's it affected your take on living in the modern world?
I think I personality-wise, I was an observer. So it made it easy to write about my childhood because I have this clear, almost video image of my childhood. And there are two kind of strands to your question. One was that my education, I was ducks of the class early at St. Louis. And then by the time I got to subleaving and leaving, I was almost at the bottom of the class. And one of my brothers failed and had to repeat. Now, we were both intelligent boys. And so that the compromising of our education really affected our careers. I couldn't go to uni. I ended up at the Perth Tech. And I ended up at university kind of through the back door, as it were. So my working professional life was profoundly affected by the education, which was... which it demolished. Yeah, absolutely. So when I left home, which was 21 or 22, I walked away from the church and I never again went into any church with a sense of a spiritual kind of commitment or a goal. And I've sort of embraced Buddhism and Taoism and other things more as principles. I really enjoyed studied philosophy at school, at university. So in parallel to, I've never said anything to anyone about the Catholic Church, you know, being a disreputable organization or anything. I've let people live their own lives. But for myself, I've sort of seen that those sorts of institutions cannot really service the inner heart of someone if they are very open. And so I've tried to, in fact, have an open heart. And so it's very easy to listen to the stories of other people, no matter what sort of religion or social background they have. And in fact, I've talked to some boys who have been abused, who are not represented in the manuscript, and been able to help them kind of just hear their story, if you like, to just sit and someone and not make any judgment or comment, but just to hear the story.
I imagine, Jared, when one eventually gets to read the published book, and I'm sure it will be one way or another, people will be a bit dumbfounded, unable to understand how these things could have happened, the psychological processes and the traumatic processes that you've been through, and they all say, my goodness, the lives that some people have had to live, Jared McCann in this case. Are there particular lessons? Are there any messages? Are there things that you want people to take away?
Well, I document at one point early in the manuscript, a point in my childhood where suicide would have been an option. And I was a moment of utter desolation where the future had gone. There was no such thing as the future. And I just was so immersed in shame. I didn't know it was called shame at the time, but this feeling of absolute total worthlessness, and that I couldn't look to the future, you know, for a career or life or anything. It was nothing. There was this, what I describe as a grey fog. And I just went inside and got on with my life. But when I unpacked that in therapy years later, I saw that that would be the point where an adolescent boy would commit suicide. And perhaps it was the gift of the good side of my parents, who were able, that I had inherited a strength and a loyalty to myself, if you like, that it didn't result in suicide. So I know in writing and interviewing boys and men for this work, several suicides that of friends who that did occur as a result of the abuses. What came out of it was, for me, was an optimism, and it came to, it was the essence that I was not to blame, it was not my fault, that it my childhood had been derailed by someone else, and that the secret had paralyzed, and that the disempowerment that kind of infected my entire life was had its roots in the secret. But then it became shame, and all of those things conspired to not tell anyone. So the first thing was to tell someone, and then to get support, because it's not your fault. And that some out through that process, the pieces started. It's like a jigsaw, Michael. I just through writing, I found lots of pieces, but also through my life, I'd found lots of pieces. But I didn't have a template that said this is how they should be, which was the realized child. And so now I can sort of look and think, oh, yes, I start to have a picture now of the realized child from all these fragments that I've been able to write about or talk about or reimagine of myself.
Is there anything you pass on to your children or to your friends, or the sort of life lessons at a daily level that you can draw from it all?
It would be to just tell the truth, however embarrassing, however shameful, however guilty you feel. And I've said this to my children. I have to say, actually, I haven't mentioned it, but having children was the greatest redemptive act of my life, because I had no notion that I would ever have children. And I found a partner, my wife, Sue, who has stuck with me through thick and thin. And we had two children. And that has been the, in a sense, the most redemptive act, because it meant that I was optimistic about the future if I could have children. But I've always said to them is that you just, the most shameful thing that you can do is if you've made a mistake is to apologize. And that's been the hardest thing to learn, is to accept that I've done something wrong, if I have, or that I've been insensitive or haven't got the message or whatever. So it's really like to just be open about who you are and what is, and to tell the truth.
Jared, you've had a wonderful career and still do as an architect, a heritage architect, well-known around and well-loved around Fremantle. Now you've become an author, shortlisted for the Hungerford Prize, which is just lovely on its own. And before we wrap this interview up now, for which I must thank you for coming on and dealing with all of my questions, what does the future hold as a writer? Have you got another topic, it could be quite different, that you are burning to write on?
I've been writing short stories most of my life, and so I have this drawer full of short stories, and I am in a writing group and have been for about 10 years, thanks to a close friend of mine who was a published author, and she said, come and join our group. And I've loved that. And one woman in the group has said that, you know, about various things that I've written, that's a great short story, you should write a short story. So I've started writing short stories, and I realized that once I start writing, it's actually not a short story. It's actually a very long story. And I can sort of see that the bones of my childhood are there. And the one I've written most recently is the narrator is a 10-year-old boy. And I realized that's the boy who existed before he was abused. And so I think that is a great story that I will just allow to have its own life and end. But I think from now, I have this feeling that I'll perhaps write something of an adolescent boy and then perhaps a 20-year-old boy, man. And finally, I'll get to the person who I am at 70 and write something then.
Jared, it's been lovely talking with you. Thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.